Hello, hello, and welcome back or welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. Thanks for joining us, subscribing, rating, reviewing, all those good things. And I appreciate everybody's commentary and notes and shares on social media. It's a blast to hear how this podcast is impacting people as we continue to dive into season three, which is talking to people who are seeking to be the best version of themselves. Now, it's been a couple weeks since we had a podcast drop. The last one was Kate Vogel. She absolutely crushed it. If you want to see her dominate on stage, she's got a concert coming up at the Troubadour. Check out all that information at katevogel.com. Now, why haven't we had a podcast in a couple weeks? Well, it's spring football. I've been on the road. So I was at ASU hanging out with Herm Edwards and their staff, called the USC Spring Game, the UCLA Spring Game, and this coming weekend I'll be calling the Cal Spring Game on the Pac-12 networks. And then after that game, I'm going to race over to the studio across the bridge in the Bay and do an NFL draft special with Curtis Conway, Mike Yam, and Anthony Heron. So make sure you tune into that. And if you love the NFL draft on Thursday night, I'm going on ESPNU Radio on Sirius XM for the first time to cover the draft. So myself and Tom Luganbill, we're literally going to be diving into the entire first round, but not necessarily how the players selected will impact the NFL, but how them leaving will impact their college football team. So a really unique take, I think, on the draft. I'm fired up to be part of that conversation. Now, the conversation you're about to hear, I think simply will fire you up for a bunch of reasons. So meet John Brinkus. I like to define John as an entrepreneurial artist. Now, you know John, and a lot of people know John, as the face and the voice around sports science. It won 6 Emmy Awards. It was on Fox, ESPN. He's basically dove into some of the greatest performers in the history of sports and exploring the science behind them. In fact, he's done over 1,200 segments on ESPN. So we're talking Jerry Rice, Larry Fitzgerald, and so on and so forth, just the who's who in sport and performance. We came out on this podcast, and of course we talked about that, but we also get to know that that is only a sliver of his story. He is truly a creative. John is a guy who loves the blank canvas, and as he likes to say, he thrives on, quote, creating something out of nothing. And our conversation, he'll dive into his life as an artist, when it was hard, when he had success, how he dealt with it, how he truly just took chances and betted on himself. I mean, John has done that so many times as a creative. I mean, he's not just the sports science guy. He's a New York Times best-selling author. The book is titled The Perfection Point. Check it out. He's a producer, a director, a writer. We're talking scripted films and features. He's a musician. He's got a band. And of course, he's got his own podcast titled The Brink of Midnight. I mean, he truly defines entrepreneurship. Now, what I love about John is that he just keeps moving. He's got a new show that has recently come out called Soul and Science, and it is NFL Draft Week, like I referenced. And what's fun about the NFL Draft is that you get to dive into a nitpick and just really uncover the gems which get drafted and the stories and the layers behind all of them. So he paired up with one of my closest friends, someone I consider family, Trent Dilfer, and created the show called Soul and Science on the NFL Network. John clearly is the science. He dives into the biomechanics of some of the top players. We're talking Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, Baker Mayfield, Luke Falk, all the top quarterbacks that are about to be selected in the NFL. And Trent, where he is an absolute master at, he dives into the soul because he can see it, he's lived it, he understands it. And if you follow him at all, watched him on television, watched the Elite 11, you know that he's as genuine as anyone you're going to come across. So bottom line, I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're an athlete, if you're a creative, John will really tap into a variety of different areas of you and your soul, and he'll do it completely bluntly. I think you'll laugh and get a kick out of how John and I have different perceptions of how we first met. I think you'll take notes about how to create a business and chase your dream, and I think you'll take some things away that'll definitely add some elements into your toolbox, which is the goal of season three. So I'm going to get out of the way. This is a conversation I've been saving for a long time. We filmed it actually last summer and finally get to share this one with all of you. Meet John Brinkus on the Life Without Limits podcast. Oh yeah, we are live in the heart of the Venice Canals. This is the Life Without Limits studio, otherwise known as Two Couches. And I'm joined by John Brinkus. John, I'm pumped to have you here for a bunch of reasons. So we're going to dive right into it because the whole purpose of this podcast is to explore the idea of what does it mean to be human. To you, what does it mean to be human?
To be human is to be imperfect. To be human is to recognize that there is excellence inside of you, but there is also the ability to do horrible things. That is being human. And the difference between doing great things and doing horrible things is a thinner line than most people think.
Okay, so we're going to build back from there. So take me to you as a child. You know, were you, I mean, we're all imperfect, but how did you view life? Because sometimes athletically minded people always want to be perfect. Curious if you were a type A individual. I mean, clearly you're organized now. We're going to get into your production company, your career with sports science, etc. But were you that way then?
So when I was a child, and this is the honest to God truth, I was the smallest kid throughout my entire education. Entering high school, I was 4'8", 86 pounds. I mean, I was tiny.
That's small.
Right? I was really small. So I was the smallest kid in kindergarten, the smallest kid in high school. I was the smallest kid, and I had the biggest ears. So I'm like this tiny kid with giant ears. Oh. And as a child, that really created who I am because I loved who I was. I loved the fact that I was small, the fact that I could exceed expectations because you're not expecting much. And I was the fastest kid in my elementary school. You know, I set the record in the presidential 600 yard dash. And, you know, I was the only kid in elementary school to get the presidential physical fitness every single year. As a friend and as a human, you know, when kids tease you and say, you know, oh, you look like a monkey, you have giant ears, you're a little tiny. I took that. I was like, you know what? I kind of do look like a monkey, and that's pretty funny. And it really set me up for not being offended, having really thick skin, learning how to get along with people who seemingly may not want to get along with you, and it always exceeding expectations. As a student, I was always a very good student. You know, I was an A student. You know, I just got A's and everything. And one of the biggest reasons why is I am a massive believer in everyone has something to teach you. You just have to listen. And in school, I listened very, very carefully. I was always the kid in the front row of the class. I listened very carefully. And from elementary school to college, I always felt like that teacher is telling me the answers that are going to be on the test. So if I just listen, then I'm going to get the test right. I never understood the concept in college of people skipping a class. I'm like, you're missing the opportunity for the teacher to tell you what to write, to tell you what to do. I'm like, I never missed a class. And that, you know, as a very, very young child, when we talk about those formative years, being the fastest, being a very good student, it set the bar for me of the way that you're just supposed to be. And my parents, you know, great parents, you know, and my mother, especially just being this loving vessel, she's like, look, as long as you're doing your best, we're all good. And when you do your best and when you can lie down and say, I did my best today, no matter what it is, if it's mowing the lawn or writing a paper, you're like, I just did my best and I'm good with that. The result of that is almost irrelevant because I can say I did my best, whether or not you give me an A or not, kind of is irrelevant to me because I know I gave an A effort. You can grade it however you want. As it turns out, I frequently got A's and I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what I expected because that's the effort that I put forward. And that has just carried me all through life.
Okay. Lots to unpack there. Okay. Because you have two children. How old are they?
They're
like 8 and 10?
They're almost 11, almost 9.
Okay. When you're their age, I'm assuming this is the time when you're kind of getting poked fun at a little bit, and your mom tells you those things. Now, as a parent to children of that age, do those things land? Like I'm thinking back at 9, and I'm like, my parents could have said the same thing, but I don't know if it would have actually landed. I would have sunk in somewhere, of course. And I ask that because I wonder if you being fast allowed you to deal with it. Because for me, it was, oh, you want to make fun of my name? All right, let's play basketball. And that's how I survived.
You know, it's interesting as a parent now, and I'll use a really great example. So Lizzie, my wife, is 5 feet tall, and I'm 5'8.5". So height is not in the cards for our kids. When our first child, at year one, he was like at the 75th percentile, you know, in size and weight. And I said, hold on a second, everyone. These charts, this is just a little snapshot for a one-year-old. We'll see what happens. So, of course, he's the smallest kid in class. Our daughter is the smallest kid. And I pretty much from the word go would tell them, you're going to be small. And you have to make peace with that. And no, it's not necessarily a disadvantage. It depends on how you use your size. I will never forget this. My son came home. He was in second grade. And he was really bummed. And I'm like, what are you bummed about, Bryce? And he said, you know, the biggest kid in class today, he called me a shrimp. And it really hurt my feelings. And I said to him, do you want to know why he called you a shrimp? Because you are. You are the smallest kid. And he called you a shrimp because you are a shrimp relative to them. What I would say back to that kid is, you know what? You might be giving me too much credit. Because in the animal world, shrimps actually aren't all that small. I'm actually more like an ant. And he went back to school, told this kid that, and they have been best friends since. And I said, when you don't allow someone making fun of you to get to you, you diffuse the joy that someone could get. Said, so when you turn it back around on them and you say, look, you've criticized me, I can see that, but here's how I would criticize myself. I'm going to one up you on that. It just takes the joy out of it for anybody. And on the do your best front, told our kids, my son is, you know, they're both excelling academically and doing great. My son is excelling in lacrosse. And our daughter, when she was 8, she won the Utah state championship in gymnastics. And so she was a state champion in gymnastics. I was never the state champion in anything. And she loves gymnastics and can't stop doing it. And I have told them both. I'm like, look, whether or not it's gymnastics or art or education or whatever it is, as long as you can say I'm doing my best and I'm trying my hardest, you're going to be good with that. Whether or not you're the state champion ever again, or whether or not anything comes of this, is irrelevant as long as you can say, I did my best and I'm good with it.
You know, I'm really curious, because the world knows you for the most part from sports science.
Right.
You know, some people were going to get into your music, but we met in a totally different way. I don't even know if you remember the first time we met.
I did. We met up at Trent Elfers.
Inaccurate. See, this is great. This is perfect. This is great.
So
a meeting was at Trent Dilfer's house at the Elite 11, and it was awesome. And that's when I got to know you and your wife on a different level as artists and creatives, and it was a blast. We ate a ton of pizza. We had a blast. Da 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 da. But
where did we first meet,
my friend? I got set up on it in the LA Hollywood industry. You get set up on what's called general meetings a lot,
right?
So you're going to go meet this production company or this network, and they're just going to know your face as a host or a talent. And I was one of those guys. And I got set up by my agent at the time to go meet you over at your production company.
Okay.
And I drive over, and it's around this like kind of weird little curvy street, and I park. I don't know where I'm going. And we have a meeting that's just, say it's at 2:00, and you guys are jamming on some show. And I'm just kicking it. And it's like 2:30, 2:45, 3:15. And I'm okay with it. I'm like,
what a jerk I am.
I'm like, hey, this is the industry. And I had done my homework on you. And to the point of, John is not just the sports science guy and not just a musician. You've done dozens of TV shows all across the globe. I was really pumped to meet you. And you roll in. And it was a great lesson for me. And you're like, all right, man, I'm really sorry. Like, we got a ton going on. So what do you got for me? And I'm like, hello, my name's Yogi. And you thought it was like a pitch meeting, which can be, you know, a lot of times these general meetings, as I learned in my career, are that. This was early on in my career. I'm going to go meet the sports science guy.
Right.
That's all I knew. And I didn't have anything. I was like, I thought it was a general. I remember calling my agent afterwards like, bro, what the hell? Like, he wanted me to pitch him something and I didn't have anything. Like, it was like a 5-minute meeting. Like, what the hell is happening here? It was a great lesson for me to always be prepared. So I tell that story because, number one, it's funny, but two, what did you lean into as a kid? Like, were you always into athletics? Because you have such a wide ranging career that I learned about due to this wacko general meeting. So
right.
Thank you for that.
That is hilarious. Well, first of all, I want to address the general meeting. First of all, I apologize. I made you wait. I promise you I was busy. Second of all, on meetings that are set up, I cannot tell you how important time management is in a day when you're super busy.
Totally.
Like every time that someone comes in and they're in my office, I'm just like, cut to the chase.
Right.
Like, we'll get to know each other through the thing, but tell me, what are you here for? I don't need a half hour of learning your backstory. I want to know, cut to your chase. I'll learn the backstory if we're interested in working together. So that's hilarious because I honestly have absolutely no recollection of that.
I killed it.
I have no recollection of that. But, you know, as a kid, what I was really gravitated toward, and this is the honest truth, was creating something out of nothing. And I always looked at life as a blank canvas, whether or not it was athletics or, you know, being the president of the school. I always wanted to create something out of nothing. I've never been a great mimicker. I've never been somebody who wanted to play a cover song. I've always been the kind of person who wanted to create my own thing, do my own thing. Really good example is, you know, in high school, so I was one of the school officers. You know, you have the president, vice president. I ran for secretary because secretary was the liaison between the principal and the students. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to be the secretary of the school. So once I become part of the student government, I said, you know what I want to do? I want to create an event that's going to last forever. That's my expectation, is I'm going to create something that's brand new. It's never been created. That's what I want to do. So I created the Mr. Madison Male Beauty Pageant Competition. And I graduated in 1989. It was my senior year. Created it out of thin air and said, you know, it's going to be really cool. It's going to become this great fundraiser because watching a male beauty pageant at the high school level, it's got to be hilarious, right? And you vote on who the people are going to be and who's going to win and all that. Like, this is going to be awesome. And to this day, it still exists. And I'm like, that's exactly what I wanted to do, was to make an impact, to make something out of nothing. And that's really what drives me. And that's how I've seen the world throughout my entire childhood and, you know, adolescence and adulthood.
When I hear that, it's awesome. But I hear a deeply rooted competitive individual, because that is basically saying, screw you, I don't need to copy what you did. Is that true? And who are you as a competitor?
So as a competitor, this is what I would say. I'm very realistic on what I should compete in. And using my speed as an example, I was the fastest and smallest kid in my elementary school. Then in my intermediate school, I was like the 10th fastest kid in eighth grade. Then when it came to high school, you know, in my grade, I was, you know, probably the 20th fastest kid. Then in my sophomore year, I just kept falling further and further behind. I peaked in sixth grade. Like, that was my peak. And I'm like, I am fascinated by why am I no longer something that was my strength? Why do I no longer have that advantage? Why have I lost that? Why am I not growing at the same rate? Why do I not have the same power to strength ratio, power to weight ratio as everybody else? That really planted the seeds in my mind of there. You've got to know what to compete in and what not. I knew, even though I used to be the fastest, I no longer was. And no matter how much I worked on it, I knew I was never going to be faster than Joey Yock, who ended up winning, you know, districts and regional and state from our school. I'm like, I'm never going to be as fast as that guy. So what is it that I should be competing in? So in terms of being a competitive person, I would like to say I'm wise where I compete. It's kind of like, you know, don't pick a fight unless you think you can win it. Like, I'm the guy, it's like, what am I actually going to fight for? And in the creative space, I feel like it's such a blank canvas that the competitive side of me that comes out really comes out on the, you know what? I'm going to make something that's so creative. It is undeniably, and my expression is, you will undeniably be able, you will have to admit it's good. Now, whether or not it's great is purely subjective, but I know I'm going to make something that's good and so good that you're going to have to admit it. And you're not going to say, ah, that sucks. You're going to say, wow, that's original. That's good. I don't even care if you like it, but you're going to have to acknowledge it.
So what's that like when you're creating something? Like, how do you embrace that? Because there could be a stress to that. There could be nervousness. There could be excitement. How do you look at it?
So I look at it in terms of creation is that, I mean, I firmly believe in a higher power. I was born and raised Catholic. Like, I am a God believing, God fearing, God loving man. I believe, especially in the creative space, that it's really this divine inspiration. And what I think unfortunately happens for most people is that they close that off and they're scared to write that first word. They're scared to take that first step. I have always been a person who is fearless on taking that step. I'm fearless on beginning that journey. And what I've found is that in creating something out of nothing, that's the excitement is, wow, it really is blank. And when I added the third step onto the first step, it sort of has changed from where I thought it was going. Maybe it's going to be pushed this way. And in everything that I've ever created, when you have the end product, you're like, did I have the absolute vision that that's the way it was absolutely going to wind up? My answer is always no, because it's such a process that you change your mind of, well, the original idea I had was good, but what I think that I made was great. And I'd love to use this expression. Good is a word you use when something is not great. I was in kindergarten, so I colored something, and I said, what do you think about this? My teacher said, yeah, it's good. So this isn't good. It's great. Good is a word you use when something is not great. It's great. And when I finish something, it's not done until I think it's great. Now, whether or not the world does or not is irrelevant to me, but I want you to undeniably exist that it's good enough to be considered good. That now we can all argue as to whether or not I'm right as to whether or not it's great.
Is that kind of the lens for you on what to dive into project wise? Because, you know, look, you alluded to it earlier. You're known as the sports science guy in the majority, at least in the athletic community. But you play in the sandbox of Hollywood, and it's not just it. A tiny percentage of Hollywood is sports, and you're playing in a much larger area. So, how do you manage? How do you even operate in that environment where you want to make something out of nothing and make it great, but you have this perceived expertise, and you're trying to be probably you're being put in that sandbox a lot. And you're like, nah, screw that. I want to play over on this beach.
It's always the not being scared to take the first step in whatever endeavor it is. And those boxes that you end up being put in, using sports science is a fantastic example. I had never hosted anything in my life ever prior to sports science. And I walked in to pitch the show, and it was at Fox Sports. And, you know, the person running running Fox Sports at the time said, well, who are you going to get to host the show? This crazy idea of getting the world's greatest athletes to come into the lab, and you're not going to pay them, and you're going to push them to the limit. Good luck, but sounds great if you can pull it off, but who are you going to get to host it? And I said, you know what? I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. You guys are going to be licensing the show from us. You're not going to commission it. We're going to make a deal where we own all the episodes and the names and the right and all that. You're going to be licensing it from it. And he said, you know who should be the host? It's a guy named George Greenberg that was running Fox Sports. He said, you're going to be the host because I love your energy. I love the way that you're presenting it. And I said, yeah, I'll be happy to, because if I suck, I'm glad to fire myself. This is not what I came in here to pitch you. But as it turns out, because my fearlessness of taking that step, I'm like, sure, I'll host it. We've been on the air now for 11 years. We won 3 Emmys at Fox Sports, another 3 Emmys at ESPN, wrote a New York Times bestselling book. We've done over 1200 segments for ESPN alone. I've, you know, gotten the great fortune of meeting, you know, the world's greatest athletes and have a front row seat to, being exposed to the greatest data set ever assembled of truly elite athletes. And I've been so fortunate, but it comes from not being scared to take that step. And if I had just sold the show, had somebody else be the host of it, and then took my normal sort of step back and kind of let it run itself, you know, once it's up and running, none of this would have happened. But it did happen because seize the day. Don't be scared to take that step. And having never hosted anything, I'm like, sure, this sounds like a good idea. And ESPN had the opportunity to say when they acquired Sports Science, they had tons of talent. They're like, no, we want you to be the talent. So all of a sudden I was on the worldwide leader in sports on this giant platform, and I'm the host of it. And I'm like, how does this happen? And it happened because I wasn't scared to take that step and just do it.
When did you think that sports science, like, what did that idea cultivate? Was it back in college? Was it when you were running laps and winning the presidential award in sixth grade?
Well, I grew up in D.C., and I had a great exposure to sports. We had three Super Bowls with the Redskins. We had an NBA championship with the Bullets. We had a World Series championship with the Baltimore Orioles and Cal Ripken's rookie season. Washington, D.C. didn't have a baseball team then. But I was really a sports fan. I mean, I was a mega sports fan because the teams were really good where I grew up. I was a really good athlete when I was young, you know, all-star in whatever I was doing. But, you know, kind of grew out of that. At the high school level, but I never lost the fascination as to why are these other people, my fellow students, why are they so much better than I am? Like, no matter how hard I work, I know I'm never going to be able to dunk a basketball. I'm never going to be able to jump. Why is that? So I had that, cultivated that fascination. Fast forward to when I'm in college, I want to be in entertainment. I'm going to the University of Virginia. It's my sophomore year. I'm saying to myself, I'm going to drop out because I'm not sure how many entertainers are, you know, being born out of the University of Virginia.
And why entertainment? And what's that feeling
so
like?
The entertainment, the reason why I wanted to get into entertainment is I felt like it was the best vehicle for me to use my skill set. I'm like, I am so willing to put myself out there and to make stuff and to create something out of nothing. That this is the best vehicle for me. And it really sort of, it's a transition in college of, I want to make movies and TV shows. That's what I want to do. So I went to a guy who was running my dean, first of all, said I was going to drop out. And he said, don't drop out. Why don't you create your own major? I'm like, you can do that? He said, yeah, just pick your major. My major is rhetoric, communication studies, the theory of the argument. He's like, take all the classes and electives underneath it. Look in your guide, and he opened up the book. He said, at the University of Virginia, you can take all independent studies. Just make your own classes. So I made a screenwriting class and a photography class and a, you know, filmmaking class. I just made up my own stuff. And you just have to find a professor to sponsor you. So I went to a guy named Bob Ghazali, who's now the president and CEO of AFI. But back then, he was just running the Virginia Independent Film Festival. And I said to him, I really want to talk to somebody who's in film and television. He said, you know what? There's this kid in the area. His name is Steven Soderbergh. He lives just outside of Charlottesville. You should track him down. He just finished a movie called Sex, Lies, and Videotape. He's about to release a second movie called Kafka. He's going to be down at the Vinegar Hill Theater screening the movie. Why don't you go track him down? So I literally went down to the Vinegar Hill Theater, invited myself to the screening, stood outside the theater, waited for Steven Soderbergh, who I had no idea what he looked like. This was way before the internet. So I'm like trying to figure out, well, who is Steven Soderbergh? I walk up to him and I'm like, hey, I'm John Brinkus. I want to do what you're doing. How do I do it? Can I do a class with you and do an independent study on how to become a filmmaker and work in film and TV? And he's like, sure. Stop. So I did an independent study with Steven Soderbergh that I got credit for from the University of Virginia. And he said to me, the way to be a filmmaker and the way to be successful, you know, whether it's film or television or entertainment, is just learn to do everything yourself. He said, don't go to film school. He's like, screw all these classes. Just teach yourself. Learn to do it yourself. Learn to shoot, learn to edit, learn to direct, learn to write, do all the steps of the process so that you then can figure out who's better than you at doing that. And if you can't find that person, then you do it yourself. I'm like, that's great advice. So fast forward of once we've created created a production company, we made a couple movies, we're making TV shows. What happened was our first big contracts. My brother-in-law was my business partner. The first big contracts we got, we our investors bought us the space age machine called an Avid. And this is just as Avid was being born. And we were the only people who really had an Avid. And it was in the basement of my parents' house. And we landed the contract for the Washington Bullets and the Washington Capitals to do all their coaches' shows, PSAs, commercials, anything that wasn't the actual game. So that got us in the sports industry. At the same time, the Discovery Channel was launching these DigiNet networks, and they had a channel called the Science Channel. And we were doing shows called Science Live, the Young Scientist Challenge. And we became, in the DC area, the experts on sport TV and science TV. And we ended up putting those two things together on a show on Discovery called XMA Extreme Martial Arts. Tom Cruise did the raps for it, was tied in with The Last Samurai, did really well for them. Guy from Discovery went over to National Geographic. He said that XMA thing was cool, but science it up for us at National Geographic. We then made a show called Fight Science that brought in, you know, the world's greatest martial artist to punch and kick the crap out of a crash test dummy to see which style generated the most amount of force. That was their top 10 of all time. Fox owned National Geographic and Fox Sports. They ran Fight Science opposite the original Sunday night Eli Manning versus Peyton Manning Sunday night football game. Fight Science at that time on Fox Sports was their like third highest rated show with no promotion. They said, what else do you have? We said, well, we got this thing, Sports Science, where we're going to take that Fight Science approach and put it all together. That was really the genesis of it. And once we started putting it together and said, I'm going to get the world's greatest athletes to come into a lab, push themselves to a limit. And they all said, well, how much are you going to pay them? I'm like, nothing. Because anybody who's great at something doesn't do it for the money. That's how I'm going to get everybody. And, you know, we're now in season 11.
When did you first verbalize, whether it was internally or in a journal or to somebody else, I'm into making something out of nothing? Because I think back to being like a sophomore in college, and we had the same exact major. I had eight different majors, and the only one I fell in love with was the last one, which was rhetoric.
Right.
And the Greek encomium of Helen and the power of speech and argument.
Ethos, pathos, logos.
100%. It's why I do what I do now.
Yep.
But when were you aware that you were down with something out of nothing?
Honestly, when I was really, really young. I was a kid that colored outside of the lines. Mm. I'd love to say like...
And nobody ever said don't. Or if they did, you liked it?
Yeah, I just liked free-forming things. And my parents, you know, we come from a very modest background. You know, my mom was working as a nurse, and she ran the nursing program at George Mason University. And my dad worked for the government for 20 years. I just came from, you know, this humble background of, you know, just great parents, but didn't come from a lot of money. But my parents just kept instilling in me, just do what you love and don't be scared and do whatever you want. And I believe this. My dad decided to work for the government because he wanted to be at every baseball game. He wanted to be a coach on my team. He wanted to go to every single event. And I think he was living his life vicariously through me of just please go do something you're in love with, because he was not in love with his job. Hmm. And he said, please, you know, go do whatever you want. And really the turning point, you know, one of the biggest moments in my life is he got me a job working for the government for the summer. And this is the summer of 1989 before I'm going into college. And the job that he got me was working in a printing room for the government. And with these giant printers, it was indoors, you know, white room, like picture like the white computer room with just one big printer where nobody had an individual printer. All the computers ran down to one printer. This is 1989. So it's like archaic technology. My job was when the printer was done printing, my job was to separate each individual job on the perforated line that was black. And I did that for 10 hours a day and sitting in a locked room. And I came home from day one and I said, Dad, I'm not going back. I'm not going to do it. He said, well, unfortunately, my boss got you that job. So you are going to go back. And I said, I will do that this summer, but I will never do anything in my life that I don't want to do. And that really was the turning point, was being locked in a printer room. Said, I will never do this. And I'm going to run wild. That's what I'm going to do. And that really sort of charted that course for me.
How do you think that you're perceived by your community? And I know you have a variety of communities. And that's a tough general question, but I'm asking it anyway.
I know, but you're asking it anyways. It's tough to say how you're, you know, how do you think you are perceived? Because there are so many, you know, a lot of people in the, you know, community know me only as a producer and only as a business owner and an entrepreneur. But you know, the vast majority of people know me within the sports world know me as the sports science guy. The way that I think I'm perceived as the sports science guy, you know, is someone who's really curious about the performance of athletes, you know, about the how and the why. And I think that I am perceived as somebody who's very curious. And I've always said that a sports science segment doesn't exist unless I've learned something from it. And that's always my bars. Like, if I'm not learning anything from this, someone else isn't either. And I don't want to put the same thing out over and over and over. But I think among in terms of just people who aren't sports science fans, just sort of people who know me or friends or just acquaintances, I'm an extreme personality. And I can honestly say, I think it's a 50-50 proposition as to whether or not you're going to like me. I'm so A-type. I always try to be kind. I always try to put the best foot forward. I rub a lot of people the wrong way. I'm very, very outgoing. And I've told my wife this from the beginning. Obviously, we have this great story where we fell instantly in love. And, you know, I always communicated to her. I'm like, you know, this is not everybody who meets me is going to love me. A lot of people are going to be turned off and think that I'm brash or I'm arrogant or I'm just, you know, obnoxious. Other people are going to find me to be charming and intelligent and generous. I said, but I'm the same person. All that I know is that I'm trying my best to do my best, to do good in the world and to do great things. That's all that I'm trying to do. But I'm not a quiet, shy presence in a room. And that's why how do I think people perceive me? I think it depends on the viewpoint you're coming from. But, you know, I've definitely been greeted with plenty of people who are like, oh man, you're the greatest guy. And plenty of people are like, oh man, that guy drives me crazy.
You know, that's interesting. And I'm going to come back to one more question on the sports science. But prior to that, you're a musician.
Yes.
And everything you just described about being loud, brash, whatever, is not the typical definition of musicians a lot of the times. It's more introspective within your thoughts, which you are as a producer when you get to know you or hear or watch your content, whether it's sports science or a show or a song. There's great depth to it when you get past the loudness of it. How does that exist or coexist?
So I said, I think, especially in the arts, I just think all things are divine. And for me, music is divine. I say this so seriously. Whether or not it was creating sports science or writing songs for our band Brink of Midnight, I'm telling you, it's coming from somewhere else. I'm just not scared to play that next note, to play that odd chord progression that I don't know why I played it like that, but I hear something in it and I'm just not scared to move that forward. And the stuff that ends up sticking, I feel very, very passionately that it's divine. And my wife and I have just written some music that I sit back and listen to, and I don't listen to it in a manner of, oh, I wrote that. I sit back and listen to it saying, I'm not sure how that happened. I just wasn't scared to play, and here it is, and I really love it. It's music I would listen to, and it's divine.
That's such an athletic mindset, right? I mean, you've been around clearly 1,200 plus athletes and all of your features. I mean, would you say that a consistent theme among them has been their ability to jump into a state of flow and have zero explanation on how they got there?
When you talk to the greatest athletes of all time and work with the people that I've been so blessed to work with, what you find is this deep, deep sense of humility and this realization of, you know what? I have done great things, but I haven't done great things because I'm simply great. I've done great things because I've worked my tail off. I've, you know, conditioned my mind, my heart, my body, my soul to be able to compete at a certain level. But the signature plays that have happened in my career are inexplicable. I can't tell you, oh, this is exactly the way it happened. It just happened. And the amount of athletes who are deeply spiritual, regardless of their religion, I mean, it's like you hear it at the end of each game when people are like, oh my God, I got to thank God for giving me the chance to be here. It is when you look at an athlete and say, what really separates the good from the great at the elite level? I keep telling everybody at the elite level, they are all amazing athletes. It's this mental spiritual connection that separates out the good from the great. And they're somehow tapping into it in a way that's providing them a strength, clarity in a moment when the normal person would fold.
How do you find that? Because you get, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but let's just say, I don't know, NBA finals happens and LeBron hits a game winning jumper and he comes off a screen and, you know, he jumps and he waits till the final second to let it release from his hands. And then they call you and within a couple hours, that puppy's on the air.
Right.
How do you do something like that, where you're analyzing and evaluating LeBron's jump shot, to pre-draft and here comes the potential number one draft pick into your studio and you get to tap into who he is on top of their athletic gifts?
Yeah, we're incredibly fortunate. The entire sports science team, we've been working together so long now, we've gotten down to, no pun intended, to science. You know, we turn segments around, you know, within an hour after game time, it's on the air on SportsCenter. I mean, we've gotten to be, incredibly proficient at turning things around. But when you get the opportunity to work with seasoned veterans, like in season one, I got to work with Jerry Rice, who I think he had just retired and he wanted to come in and still show that he could still strut his stuff. And I said to Jerry, I'm like, now don't take this the wrong way, but when you take the metrics of Jerry Rice, I'm like, you were not the tallest. You were not the fastest. You didn't have the highest vertical leap. I'm like, you weren't number one in any of the metrics. So how do you explain the fact that you're the greatest receiver, undeniably, of all time? He said, honestly, because I knew the guys behind me were bigger, stronger, faster, could jump higher, and could take my job in a second. And he said, so I knew I had to work that much harder. He said, there's this whole myth that my dad was a bricklayer and I caught bricks and that's why I have such good hands. He's like, catching a brick and a football are two completely different things, first of all. So it's just a myth. But I worked so hard. He said, I was the first to show up, the last to leave. I had to work harder, otherwise I would lose my job. And he's like, that's what made me figure out, if I run a route more efficiently than anybody else, if I'm more precise than any other receiver ever, that's going to give me the separation that my, for lack of a better phrase, lack of speed is going to give me. If I'm more precise than the guy that's behind me, who is faster than I am, isn't going to be able to get that separation. And so I tapped into knowing what I needed to work on, and he worked on it relentlessly. The guys that we have in the lab for our own sports science NFL combine, when I look at them, get to evaluate them, one of the number one things that we look at is, obviously we're looking at raw metrics, but you're also looking at, where do they feel like they sit in the world right now? Do they think they're going to take over the world, or do they feel like they have a lot to learn? And the guys that come in who are, you know, just amazing athletes, but have that sense of humility and don't think they're going to take over the world immediately, are the ones who really thrive at the next level, because their ears and eyes are open and they want to learn. And you have such great teachers at the NFL level, as you know, that you still have a lot to learn. Those are the people who succeed.
Ears open, right? Eyes open. You talked about listening earlier and how it's one of your greatest skills all the way back from elementary school. To transition to the music, you know,
yes.
Brink of Midnight is your band's name. You met your wife in this amazing story she tells in her episode of the Life Without Limits podcast. Check that one out. But you didn't start doing music together. You waited a while.
No.
How does it begin?
So it begins. So the band formed, and this is the honest
band.
Story.
Band, I love this.
So this is the honest story. I wanted to learn to play. I played violin when I was little, and I was pretty good at violin, but I didn't dig it. I just didn't like it. I remember being petrified, telling my parents, "Hey, I don't want to play violin anymore." I was, you know, first chair violin in my elementary school. And I'm like, I'm just not digging this, just not having fun with it. But I was, I had a musical brain for sure. I just didn't like it. So I put it down. Then I turned. And then when I got to college, I'm like, you know what? that was a mistake, man. I never should have quit playing an instrument. I just quit playing instruments altogether. I said, I'm 19 years old and I want to learn how to play guitar because I really should have kept with it. So to learn to play guitar, I walked into Tower Records when Tower Records existed, walked up to the cashier and I said, who's the best guitar player in Northern Virginia? Who is it? He said, you know what? There's a guy that's working in our stock room and he's in this thrash metal band that's getting a lot of attention and he's the greatest guitarist I've ever seen. So I walk back to the stock room and I say, hey, his name is Louis Denslow. And I said, I'm looking for Louis Denslow. And Louis comes out. I'm like, I want you to teach me guitar because I want to learn how to play. And this is an example of me just cutting right to the chase. I'm not like dancing around, like teach me to play guitar. It's like going up to Soderbergh and saying, I want to do what you're doing. So he teaches me guitar and I become fairly proficient in guitar. And when I say fairly proficient is because Eddie Van Halen is amazing, right? John Brancus can play guitar. You know, like I can play guitar. I'm all right. I can mimic, you know, some of Eddie's stuff, but I'm not, by no means am I this, you know, amazing guitar player, but I feel like, look, I'm pretty good. I can play and I can write some interesting music. So I play guitar for honestly only a couple years and I get to be, you know, decent at guitar. I put it down, start our company, make movies, TV shows, you know, meet Lizzie, get married, have kids. And I honestly didn't pick guitar up again till 20 years later. I put it down until I was about 40. I'm 45 years old now. And I put it down for 20 years. And I said, I really regret not playing guitar. So I just picked it back up, started playing again. And I said, you know what? I want to write my own stuff. So I taught myself Pro Tools, got a system in my house, started playing song, and I just started making my own stuff. I didn't want, I'm like, I don't want to play a bunch of covers. Like always, I just want to make stuff. So I started just making stuff. Lizzie comes walking by, sings a melody over it. And I'm like, where did that come from? And she'll say, you know, well, we knew it, her answer was, I was classically trained in the Long Beach Opera Company. You know that. I'm like, I did. I knew that you were, I'm like, you never told me that. She's like, I've told you that 50 times. Like, I have no recollection of you ever saying that you can sing, like sing, sing, sing. And she's like, I've told you 50 times. I'm like, you're amazing. And these melodies that she was coming up with over the songs that I was just writing just for fun as an outlet. I'm like, putting the two of us together is going to be magical. When we put out our first Christmas song, on a total whim, like, let's write a Christmas song. Sirius XM Holly, which is the biggest Christmas station in the world, picked it up. We were the only unsigned artist. So it literally, their playlist went Madonna, Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney, Lizzie and John Brancus, you know, Bing Crosby. I'm like, what is going on? So that song ended up charting and tons of stations around the country picked it up. And it was, you know, our YouTube video got 3 million hits, lickety split. I'm like, we're making a band because I've got so much music that I've written now. And we put out Brink of Midnight. And Brink of Midnight is now our band. And, you know, it's one of my main focuses is, you know, in addition to sports science, you know, I'm writing music and we're now doing a podcast. And, you know, it's all things Brink of Midnight now. It's so much fun. It's such a blast. And it really reflects, you know, who Lizzie and I are as people. It's just, it's so fulfilling and rewarding.
She gave a great definition of the title of your band, Brink of Midnight. What's your definition of that?
My definition is it's the end of one moment and the beginning of the next. It's the inflection point in your life. For us, figuring out 10 years into marriage that, hey, we can make music together. That's a Brink of Midnight moment. Mm-hmm. Sitting next to each other on a plane and meeting for the first time and realizing we live two blocks away from each other on the same street in Brentwood. That's a Brink of Midnight moment. These inflection points that you have in your life, it's the end of one chapter and the beginning of another. And from that point forward, nothing in your life is ever going to be the same. Everything changes.
Erwin McManus is a good friend of the program, and he writes this book called The Artisan Soul. And the whole idea is that we're all artists. And at some point in your life, you're told you're not. You know, maybe it could have been your art teacher who said, you know, that's actually bad. That's not even good. Do you consider yourself an artist? Because some would consider you like, oh yeah, he's the science guy, right? Or yeah, I heard he did a little music, or yeah, he's done some sports content. You know, how do you see yourself as a quote unquote artist?
This is how I view myself. I'm an entrepreneurial artist. And what I mean by that is not that it's necessarily a business. It's that I'm starting something out of the love of doing it and growing it. Like, I want to create something, and I'm not satisfied with creating something and then just locking it away. I need for it to be out in the universe. And this is what's interesting, but I don't need everyone to like it. I don't have that insecurity, because from a little kid, if I think it's great, I'm good with that. I want to put it out there for debate. I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'm wrong. I think it's great, but I want you to at least consider it good enough to be good. And then let's all collectively debate whether or not it's great. And that's fine. And I'm totally fine with someone disagreeing with me, but I've got to put it out there just to test yourself and to have the courage to say, this is what I think is great.
Have you had a low moment in your career? Oh, and God. If so, what's that like for you?
we don't have enough times to talk about low moments, but there are.
Like, how do you define a low moment? Because I feel like you can move on from things.
Man, my brother-in-law, who's my business partner, you know, he had a JD MBA. He was a lawyer. He was, you know, he had the business degree, and he was really the business mind, and I was really the creative mind, but our responsibilities kind of crossed over. There were so many times where we'll be on a project and my head will just explode and literally just say, oh my God, I can't see where I'm going right now. Like, somehow I thought I knew where I was going, and I can't see it now. I don't know why. And it's only happened a handful of times in my life. My brother-in-law had a fantastic expression that he said to me. He said, don't experience Armageddon until it happens. And he said, when you're feeling lost, that's the time to keep moving forward in the direction you thought you were supposed to go. You're just in a dark patch. You just can't see the light. You just got to keep moving forward. Otherwise, you're going to experience Armageddon prematurely. He's like, maybe the end of the world is coming. Maybe the end of everything is coming. But don't let you determine that. Let life determine that. Let the world, universe determine that. And my, you know, my low points of the only reason why I say it, I only have a handful, you know, but the creation of Sports Science was one of those moments, to be quite honest. It was one of the hardest things I had ever gone through. It was so difficult to meet the deadlines and to get the right vibe and to get the right athletes and get the right timing of it and figure it all out. It was, and I just had my, you know, my second child. We just had, you know, our daughter, and being a new father and having a newborn in the house and not sleeping and, you know, trudging on and making this thing. It was a real struggle for me that I knew I had to complete. But without my brother-in-law being there by my side, like my mother, being by my side, you know, always, it was, you got to go forward. And I'll tell you one low moment that was genuinely probably the lowest that I had ever been. When I got out of school after University of Virginia, I went up to New York to make a movie. And this is after I'm like, dude, I am going to set the town on fire, man. I am here. Listen to me roar. I made some short movies in college, wrote a script and a book, and, you know, learned how to make a movie. But I did it all myself. Got out, you know, put together, you know, probably 50 to 100 grand of friends and family money. We get a producer up in New York, and he puts together a killer crew. I mean, it's a 40 person crew on a movie. I've never directed anybody in my life, because I took Soderbergh's advice and I did everything myself. I show up on day one, and you have these 40 seasoned professionals looking at me saying, what do you want us to do? And I am just so in over my head. I'm like, oh my God. It was an 18-hour shoot day. It was such a miserable day, because I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, I wanted to, this is what I've always wanted to do, but I'm not sure now what exactly I am doing. I went home, it was 2 a.m, called my mom. And I said, and this is obviously way before cell phones, called my mom on the hard line. And I said, Mom, I can't do this. And she, and what I was waiting to hear back from her was, that's okay, baby. It's going to be fine. She said to me, little late for you to decide that. Your decision has already been made. Don't you dare say to me, you're not going to do this, because this is what you said you wanted to do. You're going to get up, go back in there, and you're going to finish this movie. That's your job. That's what you said you wanted to do. Like, there was no compassion. And I'm like, oh my God, you're right. So I got up and trudged along and trudged along and trudged along and kept taking that step forward. And that I was so low, ready to just like quit, that it took my mother saying, you're not allowed to, because you set your intention. The ball's in motion. You can't stop it. It's a little late to quit. So that was one of my low points.
So how did the movie end?
The movie ends.
How long did you shoot for?
So, oh my God, it took us 2 years to make this movie. We made this movie. It was called Crimson Lights. Got great reviews, and you know the Washington Post, and you know bunch of papers around the country. Opened up some festivals, and it was in the circuit where we were playing the same festivals as Clerks. You know, it was like it was all that era of like new indie movies. And when I say we were inches from the finish line of getting a major distribution deal, I mean, it was like inches. You know, Miramax wasn't Miramax yet, but Miramax was still one of the bigger players in the space. I mean, we had everybody like, all right, you know, we really love this movie and it's great and it's awesome. And we ended up getting a distribution deal with a smaller distributor. They ended up, like many distributors did in the 90s, they went out, exploited it, made a bunch of movie, filed for bankruptcy. We saw not a dime. And that happens all the time. But that was a giant lesson for me of our, but from that movie, our investors were so impressed with it that they gave us money to buy this space age machine called the Avid. But what it really taught me was, you know what? Whether or not you make money off of something, whether or not you get a big distribution deal, whether or not, that doesn't reflect on how good the piece of art actually is. It doesn't mean anything one way or the other, because there are plenty of horrible movies that make a bunch of money that you scratch your head going, how did that happen? And how did something that, you know, everybody else in the industry thinks is great, it just never sees the light of day? It happens, obviously, not just to me. It happens to everybody. And that's why I'm not driven by praise or awards or, you know, fame or anything. I'm driven by doing it and making it something that I consider to be great.
Speaking of making something, you just created a new podcast. What's this process been like for you? Because you've been driving around, you've been picking off podcasts left and right. We can find this podcast on iTunes and all the platforms. Yep. What is that? Those types of long form conversations been like for you?
So the Brink of Midnight podcast focuses on those moments in everyone's life where everything changed. And I've had the world's greatest athletes on, you know, we're, you know, getting tons of comics on, getting philanthropists and CEOs and a lot of everyday people where I'm like, I want to know the story. What's amazing is that everybody has a moment that changed their life for better or worse. It was, you know what? This was my low point, or you know what? This was the epiphany that I had. And it's the stories are blowing me away. I think the audience is totally going to dig it. You should download the Brink of Midnight podcast. You'll be blown away by, you know, what someone's moment was that changed their life forever.
So we got a podcast. We got old school movies, scripted, non-scripted television. Clearly, sports science is continually thriving.
The band
is rolling. Where do you lean in the most? Like, or do you need a variety? You know, I'm curious. Out of all those elements, you know, what it makes you feel most alive?
You know, creating something out of nothing makes me feel alive, and it's taken so many different forms over the years. I'm happiest. I mean, right now, I'm happiest writing a song. That's just, you know, I've made TV shows for so long. That's, you know, the TV thing is sort of, you know, I did that for 23 years, you know, of just creating new shows, you know, creating music. Now I feel it for me when I'm writing a song, it's just like falling in love when, you know, Lizzie and I met and we spent 5 hours together in an airport and, you know, 2.5 hours on the way back. We had 7 hours and it goes by in the blink of an eye. When I sit down with my guitar and I just start writing something, I mean, 10 hours could go by and I just wouldn't even know that it was a half hour. It's like you lose yourself completely. And to me, you allow that divine inspiration to work through you. Time has a very different meaning in those moments. And that's what makes me feel most alive.
Wow. Just got back from the Middle East and we asked a bunch of people what they think it means to love. And it seems as though were loved by a family that taught you principles that are amazing. And clearly you love what you drive or throw yourself into creatively. But overall, if you had to take a step back and look at that question about what does it mean to love, how would you answer that?
I think loving, there are two aspects to it. One is putting something in front of yourself. Being willing to say, you know what? I love this thing so much, this person, this whatever. It's more important than I am. And it eliminates, loving something eliminates the idea of compromise. I mean, when people say the key to a successful relationship is compromise, I'm like, no, it's not. I mean, loving is not compromising. You're doing something that someone else wants to do. You're loving them. That's not a compromise. It's a choice. Like that to me is that's what genuine love is. And when you have the, you know, that's sort of like your marital love of like, look, I love you so much. I'm going to go see the movie that you want to see, not because I'm compromising and it's because you want to see it. That's my act of love. Like that, it's great. I think like the world love, the idea of love thy neighbor. I think the idea of love, of what love is doing your best. I really honestly believe that. And when I say that of doing your best, of when there's a piece of trash on the street, do you walk by it or do you pick it up? Are you doing your best if you walk by it or should you pick it up? When you see somebody in need, do you help them or do you walk right on by? When you see somebody, do you smile or do you frown? Do you ignore them? When you talk to someone, do you show interest, genuine interest in something they like? Or do you just want to talk and hear yourself talk? Doing your best is loving. That's loving the universe. And that is, I think we're all put here to love, which is do your best. And that is the solution to all of the problems in your personal life, in your professional life, is if you can lie down at night and say, you know what? I did my best. And when you don't do your best, you apologize, whether it's to the universe or to your neighbor or to your spouse. You're like, you know what? I tripped today. Right. You know, I didn't do my best, but I think that's what love is.
Wow. Last couple, we'll get you out of here. Through this creative process, you referenced, I think it was your daughter being born when you were going through the sports science content. And obviously all the stuff we referenced with Brink of Midnight. What do you think your kids have absorbed from you over the last, I guess, call it 7 years or so when they've kind of been aware of maybe what you've been doing?
I would hope that what they keep hearing from me is the just do your best. And that's what my parents told me. And that's your guiding principle. And whether or not it's taking the high ground on the playground or studying for a test and doing your best or playing a sport and trying your hardest, I'm like, it's just about doing your best. And that's it. It's doing your best in everything. I'm not a, you know, if my children don't get the best grade in the class, that doesn't mean they failed. I'm like, did you try your best? Did you do your best? The answer is yes. I'm like, I'm totally cool with whatever the result was from that because you did your best and that's fine. That's what I really am trying to instill in them. And I think, you know, it appears that it's working because I feel so blessed that we just have two such wonderful children.
You meet your wife on a plane, you have a beautiful family, you go through the ebbs and flows of moving in life, you work with her brother, and now you have this band. I'm curious.
I work with my sister's husband.
Oh, okay. Excuse
me. My brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. How do you view your relationship now with her since you guys have created music? Has it shifted?
It hasn't shifted. It's just grown. And when you genuinely love someone, and I think that this is true for everything, it's unimaginable how much you're going to love them tomorrow versus today. It seems unimaginable that you could love somebody more. But each day that goes by, true love, genuine love, continues to grow. And this discovery, 10 years into marriage, that we can make awesome music together was just another step of like, I'm just not sure that I could love you any more than I did yesterday, but I do. We keep growing, and that growth is so important. And Lizzie and I are such a perfect match. In fact, when we met, she was holding a book called A Perfect Match. That was the book she was holding when we met. That it is 100% true. We both are, we are the most introverted extroverts ever. Like, we're totally cool being by ourselves, creating, just, you know, going for a run or writing a song or just doing something by ourselves. We're totally cool with that, but we can't live without each other. And every day, you know, that love grows just because we keep stretching and keep morphing as human beings. And, you know, as long as you're stretching and growing and trying your best, you know, love will just keep on expanding.
That's badass. How do you feel about the word limits?
I have a different view on limits. So I wrote a book called The Perfection Point. New York Times bestselling book that analyzed what is the fastest a human being could possibly run. What is the limit of human performance? That's what the book was all about. I think limits are important. And this is why I say that. Language is a perfect example. Language is just agreed upon symbols that have meaning, but it's our collective understanding that we're limiting what we're saying. Because if it was limitless, we would never be able to understand each other. We have to pare it down to something that we can digest and something that we agree has common meaning. When you look at the world of athletics, when people say, you know, you could do anything you want, I love to say, no, you can do anything you can. You can't do anything you want. I'm like, I can say right now, I want to play linebacker in the NFL. That's never going to happen. No matter what happened, I'm 45 years old. I'm, you know, had a gazillion surgeries. I can't do that. So you can't say, well, you can do anything you want. The idea of you can do anything that you put your mind to me, it needs to fall into the realm of something you can do. And that's a very important realization. Can I be president? Sure. I can be president. Do I want to be president? Well, that's a different question. But those two things match up as something that is limitless. Yeah, like, sure, I can be a president, but the idea of that being something of, well, that you have no limit in what you can do in the government, that's just a recognition. But there is a limit to athletically. I want to break 9 seconds in the 100-meter dash. No human being is going to do that, and I'm not going to do that. So you have to recognize what you can do, and I think recognizing those limits is really important. In the music world, is it possible for our music to affect people? Yeah. Is it possible for our music to continue to allow us to grow as people? Yeah. Therefore, I want to do it. It's possible that this music keeps going on and on and on and growing and growing and growing. That's possible. Athletically, is it possible for me to do, you know, can I play in the NBA? No, I can't. So it's important to know that there are limits.
I love that answer, man. This has been a blast. Way better than our first general meeting. Definitely longer.
Wow. I want to know what you... I want a transcript of that meeting.
Yeah. Honestly, though, it's been a blast getting to know you, man. Awesome. I appreciate it. You're an inspiration to me and many other people, and I think people are going to dig this. How can people make sure they get a hold of you and your music and your recent projects?
So you can go to brinkofmidnight.com. It's everywhere. If you go to johnbrinkus.com, it forwards to Brink of Midnight. That's a great place to get it, and also to check out anything sports science. You just type in sports science anywhere on YouTube or ESPN or whatever, and there are, you know, over 1,000 clips all over the place. So, yeah, music and sports and science and, you know, podcasting now, it's always just been a blast.
I love it. Creating something out of nothing. We appreciate the time. As always, we end on this podcast. A reminder, and John just did, the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.